Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Well, welcome everybody to Week, the political roundtable from the Commonwealth Club of California for Monday, June 30th, 2014. Thanks for joining us tonight. I'm John Zipperer, the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial, and I'm pleased to be your host for tonight's program. On today's program, we're going to look at Governor Brown's, let's call it a sleeper campaign for re-election, Texas Governor Rick Perry and his recent controversial comments here at the club, in fact, the recent end-of-term Supreme Court decisions, how George Lucas's museum plans affect the Bay Area, and we'll also check in on some other local and other elections of interest. So as always, we'll try to provide some insight into these issues, and any opinions expressed are those solely of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club of California. Now let's meet our panelists for today. I'm going to start on the end there with Melissa Griffin Kane. She is a contributor to KPIX-TV with her Mornings with Melissa segment, and also to San Francisco Magazine. She's also an attorney, and you can find her on Twitter at Mel Griffin Kane. Next to her is Martin G. Reynolds. He's the senior editor for community engagement and training at Bay Area News Group Digital First Media, and he is the co-founder of Voices. He's not an attorney, but he is still on Twitter at Reynolds Post. And we're pleased to welcome to our stage for the first time Molly Riley, the deputy politics editor at Huffington Post, based here in San Francisco. And she is on Twitter at Molly Claire. Why she's not on Twitter at Molly Riley, we'll quiz her about that later. So there are question cards spread throughout the room. Please write down your questions and submit them. I will do my best to get as many as possible asked during the program. And in fact, one of the topics we're going to be talking about is the Supreme Court decisions. They sent down some major ones just over the past few days before they kind of headed out of town. So we definitely want to hear what you have to say, your questions and comments about those topics. So on to our roundtable. We'll get to that a little bit later. But first, let's start with Governor Jerry Brown and Neel Kashkari. Earlier this month, Republican voters chose their candidate to seek the California governor's office. Moderate Neel Kashkari beat populist conservative Tim Donnelly. So we're in the general election. In the biggest non-surprise of the year, polls show that Governor Brown is well ahead in the gubernatorial race. So let me start with you, Martin. Is this race over? Is it truly a sleeper for everybody?
Well, it is a sleeper. I was up in Sacramento over the weekend, and if any indication, I was talking to a colleague who does a lot of public relations for many of the folks working around the Capitol, and without a doubt, the folks he's talking to have already moved on. It's like they're already on summer vacation. They're not even thinking about this. They said it's a done deal and looking forward to Brown's next term, and I think when you have a governor that's got a 54% approval rating in a state as diverse as California, I think that says a lot.
Melissa, is this...
Well, actually, the same poll that showed a 54% approval rating showed that 13% of GOP respondents actually approved of the governor, which sounds like a lot if you think about, you know, partisan divide in America today. It seems to me like that Neel Kashkari is being a good soldier, and he is not going to raise a ton of money, and he's not going to see the kind of backing that an Ashley Swearengen, for example, the Republican nominee for treasurer, is going to get because she actually has a chance. But he's going to be a good soldier, and it seems to me like he's trying to lay the groundwork for a run in 2018 when you're going to see either maybe Gavin Newsom, Kamala Harris, Antonio Villaraigosa. There's a ton of Democrats lining up, maybe George Clooney, depending on who you believe. Please. Every political nerd is like, oh, my God. So, you know, we could see any number of Democratic candidates. I think he's trying to position himself as the reasonable Republican candidate, the consensus candidate for 2018. So I think even he knows deep down that he doesn't really stand much of a chance. But he's getting his name out there, which is a big part of running for office in California. And he's just going to toe the line and help the Republicans who are down ticket, who actually have a chance, people running for controller, et cetera.
And Molly, Neil Kashkari is kind of trying to redefine the Republican Party in the state, is that right?
Right. And I think there's two important things to look at. The first is that the Republicans did not elect Tim Donnelly, who was this Tea Party candidate. He was the founder of the Minutemen, which was this extreme anti-immigration group that would stand at the border and call people insurgents for trying to come to the states. So that really benefits Republicans down ticket, for sure. That could have fired up a lot of Democrats who weren't otherwise going to vote and, you know, voted the party line and hurt those Republicans down. But the second thing is that Republicans across the board, across the country, have realized that what they've been doing is not working. After the 2012 election, Reince Priebus, the RNC chair, commissioned an autopsy of the Republican Party to see what was happening.
And that's not her term.
No, that is actually what they called
it. Yeah.
Which says a lot. But they found, you know, that they're having trouble reaching out to Latinos, to women. So, as no surprise. So what Neil Kashkari has the opportunity to do is, like Melissa said, really look to 2018, look to attract some of these younger Republicans who believe in gay marriage, you know, believe in abortion rights, care about the environment, care about immigration. So maybe the case is closed on 2014, but 2018 is definitely an opportunity for them.
And I'll just add as well, if talk about the autopsy, the path to victory document that emerged. It hasn't taken hold everywhere, right? I mean, we see in some places, you know, a more extreme move to the right. California seems to be the one place where every single Republican on the statewide ballot in November is a social liberal and more of a fiscal conservative. And so we're kind of seeing a road test of is this the way to fix the Republican Party? Because there's a lot of people in the party and outside of it who say, here's how you do it. You know, let go of the social issues, focus on the financial issues, and this is how you can win. And California is really now the test case for implementation of that autopsy report. It's absolutely going to be on everybody's radar. Again, even contests that, you know, maybe 15% of our population cares about are going to be viewed very, very closely by the rest of the party to determine how they can move forward as well, particularly in blue states.
Speaking after the June 2nd primary election, Governor Jerry Brown, who of course came in first place, he said, quote, "Someone once told me you win elections the year before. What won this election tonight is curing a $27 billion deficit, keeping my promise not to raise taxes unless the people themselves voted for it, and bringing government closer to the people," unquote. So is that Governor Brown's platform? Look what I did. More of the same. Does he have a campaign slogan? Does anyone know?
Maybe it's "I already won."
Care to make any predictions what the spread will be between them in November?
Yeah, I think it'll be money on that one.
Well, to be fair, though, I mean, to your point, though, we're going to see such a low turnout because you don't have a Tim Donnelly on there to fire up, so arguably either side, and there's really nothing on the initiative side that's going to get people fired up. There's the whole doctor pee in a cup thing, but like that's not nobody
explain
cares about that.
There's the
ballot initiative to raise the cap on medical malpractice claims in California. Right now, it's Governor Jerry Brown in the 70s signed a bill that capped malpractice lawsuits to $250,000, and it hasn't been adjusted for inflation. And if you did, it would be over $1 million. And so the real issue on the ballot is to lift that cap. But what they decided when they were out having little, you know, sessions with people to try to determine what kind of political messaging sticks was that people were surprised to hear that doctors are not drug tested on a regular basis. So they clapped that on to raising the medical malpractice cap, and which plaintiff's attorneys really want. And so now it becomes, so all they're focusing on is the doctor. And again, I'm not, your friends in Sacramento will tell you, they call it the pee in the cup initiative. Like, that's just kind of, I did not make that up. So the pee in the cup initiative is now to test doctors. Oh, and by the way, it's got this other thing that we really care about, which is raising the minimum. So there's that. But it's hard to believe that people are going to, that's going to rally people necessarily to the polls. So you're going to see such a low turnout that, yes, he's going to win, but is he going to win by, you know, by margins that he would if Democrats were really flocking to the polls for some reason? No, it's going to cut down a little bit on his margin, but I don't think anyone's you know, of the belief that that's not a done deal.
Very good. Well, let's talk about a different governor for our next topic. This was Texas Governor Rick Perry. He has been making a number of trips to California over the years to try to lure businesses to Texas, his argument being they have lower taxes, less regulation, more buildings blowing up, but lower taxes. That's what he really wants them to focus on. And so he came to here. He spoke to the Commonwealth Club, and he was mainly talking about energy and the economy and critiquing President Obama's energy plan. But he was asked a question about something else, and that is the Texas GOP had recently voted to, I don't know if they endorsed or just support the concept of reparative therapy, which is a scientifically debunked idea that you can change someone's sexual orientation. Perry said that he started by saying he's not a scientist and should have stopped there, but he went on. And he compared homosexuality to alcoholism, something he said was an urge that can be controlled. So he kind of, you know, argued that with scientists as well. But this became a huge national thing. And I know this because I spent the entire next day trying to make sure that our wonderful video and audio folks could get the video to all the news departments and networks that wanted that clip of him saying that. But some interesting things, and I want to start with you, Molly. There were not a lot of Republicans, especially national Republicans, who were rushing to Rick Perry's defense. There was a lot of silence and a lot of, like, Rick Perry saying, he's wrong. What do you make of this? I mean, what does this say about the Republican Party these days on this topic?
Well, the first thing I thought of was, if you remember back in 2011 when Rick Perry was running for president, and he put out this ad that he was, like, in this sort of rugged setting, and he kind of looked like a character from Brokeback Mountain, which was ironic, but it was very anti-gay. And, you know, it was a different reaction then. You know, Democrats were outraged, but Republicans kind of were like, okay, this is what our party stance is. But now the tides have changed a lot, and that was just 3 years ago. I think it's 55% of Americans now support same-sex marriage, and that number is only growing. We've seen tons of states turn back their or get their bans on gay marriage overturned in the last year since JOMO went down. So Rick Perry is just really on the wrong side of this issue, and I think more and more Republicans are realizing that. We see more Republicans in the Senate starting to come out in favor of gay marriage. Susan Collins from Maine came out last week in favor of it. And I think that's just going to snowball. So Rick Perry, I think, is sort of that last vestige of the Republican Party that's starting to fade out a little bit.
Mm-hmm. You agree, Martin?
Yeah, I do agree. And I think, you know, he might have put those glasses on, but he still sounds dumb. And when you make claims like that, it's ridiculous.
And you're going to have to keep talking until Melissa stops.
I'm sorry.
These opinions are mine.
I love it.
No, I just think it's awful at a time like this. I mean, 19 states now have ratified the support of gay marriage, and I think that's a good thing for this country. And I think that I don't understand how Mr. Perry can even be a governor of a state as large as Texas. It has, I'm sure, some smart people in it. And I don't mean to disparage my Texas, although I'm a Niners fan and don't like the Cowboys. So, but I think that was a really upsetting moment, and I was happy to see the Republicans distancing themselves from that. But I don't know if it's because they actually believe it or because they're at least smart enough to know that that's not going to win them votes.
He said he stepped in it.
Yeah.
Which is also what he said in 2011 after he forgot that third branch of government he would like to shut down. So I'm just picturing it. I read it and I thought, oh, well, there's your Democratic commercial right there. Rick Perry's steps in it.
That's his bumper sticker.
He's clearly not come up with any new line for himself. And you'd think, you know, I know we talk about Hillary Clinton and we may get to that later, but these presidential candidates who continue to misspeak, I hope they're just getting the kinks out early on because
it doesn't matter.
Have a presidential candidate making these comments if he's not going to stay with it. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, you either commit, like a Rick Santorum, and say, this is what I think, or you don't, but you can't keep going around, you know, oops, again.
I think, and this is something maybe especially in San Francisco, a lot of liberals kind of aren't aware of, is that what he said was, in a sense, kind of the progressive attitude of this ultra-conservative wing of the Republican Party that he's in. I mean, he's not even what you would consider a mainstream evangelical, not even a mainstream conservative evangelical. It's very much him and Michelle Bachmann in a sect, and I'm not even trying to cast aspersions on it. I'm trying to describe it, but you know, the old line would have been homosexuals are of the devil. They are destroying the fabric of society, and he was saying, "Oh no, this is something that's normal.
Right, yeah. We can fix them.
Yes, they just need willpower. They just need this therapy or whatever." And I don't think he was quite realizing maybe that might work when he's talking to audiences of like-minded folks, but when you take it out where the microphones are working and people can hear you outside of that, it causes some trouble. Interesting, last to show everyone comes to the Commonwealth Club, last Thursday we had a program with David Boies and Ted Olson, who are the bipartisan team of lawyers who won the Prop 8 case that went all the way to the Supreme Court. And introducing that program was actually Star Trek actor George Takei, who was there with his husband. And Takei introduced the program, and he started off just reading the names of all of these states that have either on their own legalized it or have had court decisions strike down same-sex marriage bans. And I, one example, and I tend to go back to this because I'm from Wisconsin, but Wisconsin is one of the states that recently had its ban knocked down. It's currently being appealed. But according to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel this morning, when Wisconsin passed its ban on gay marriage, only one county in the state actually voted against the ban. Today, the polls show they can't find a majority anywhere that supports the ban. I mean, it has been a sea change. Yeah. Well, then, let's move on to another topic. George Lucas is a filmmaker who has retired and sold his company to Disney, and has a whole bunch of stuff that he wants to put into a museum. Now, he actually wants to build and endow the museum, pay for it himself, $700 million project, and his first choice was here in San Francisco. He is a Bay Area native, especially as those of you who have seen American Graffiti know. He was reliving his childhood there through that. However, his wife, Melody Hobson, is a Chicagoan, so they spent some of their time there. Chicago just won, after a long, extended bidding, argument-type competition, the site for this big museum that he's going to have built. It's now going to be built along what they call their museum campus. If you know Chicago, it means it's going to be freezing cold in the winter. But that's a decision he made. Martin, you know some people who are kind of involved in this.
I think this is, according to the sources that I've been talking to, the real challenge here was navigating the relationship with the Presidio Trust. And that, in my understanding, is that upon the signing of this deal, that Lucasfilms was out at Skywalker Ranch, out in Marin County. He's also got the Grady Ranch that's connected to that property. Also, I think Little Rock. He wanted to do some construction out there, mm-hmm. ran into some issues, was planning to give $5 million to restore a creek bed. There's hiking trails on the ranch out there in Skywalker that he had maintained and kept open. And the buildings that he had were off the road and also very aesthetically pleasing. And so this is a sort of a corporate neighbor who had been known for being very, very good to the communities that he was in and respectful of them. And yet he still ran into all this trouble. So now jump on into the Presidio. The signing of the agreement, from the sources that I've spoken to, it was already discussed that he wanted to do a museum. So it wasn't like this was all of a sudden you came in, moved into somebody's house and want to build a wing and that was not discussed. It was. And so this proposal was presented, all the back and forth happened, and George, this is a man who sold his company for $4.1 billion.
Billion,
with a B. This is the Star Wars legacy. Now, admittedly, I am a Star Wars nerd and came up in that time. But my question is how is the Presidio Trust going to allow a project like this not to happen? You've got to figure out a way to make something like this happen. The building that Skywalker relocated to and they built in the Presidio is very aesthetically pleasing for the area. It looks very nice. He certainly was going to replicate that. He has also, for those who don't know, he's one of the most avid collectors, has a huge collection of American art. I think one of the largest collections of Norman Rockwell paintings, him and Steven Spielberg are sort of fighting that out. And so the fact that this didn't happen, all of this back and forth, the challenge that it took for him to deal with those folks in the trust, what I'm told, he finally just said, forget it, and went to Chicago. His wife is there. Rahm Emanuel was like, whatever you need, let's do this.
Yeah,
and they made it happen. And so the large question I have, and when you think about San Francisco and the Bay Area in general, is there seems to be this unwillingness to let big projects go through. It's so difficult to make big creative things happen in our community. And obviously, I'm one who believes that you have to have checks and balances. You got to make sure what's going in someplace works and fits. And the Presidio is a beautiful place, and I understand that they need to make sure. But this is a person who's really shown himself to be very mindful and respectful of the environment. And so I think the question is largely, why is it such a challenge to get big projects like this through in this community? And Oakland has been facing that, the Army base. I was an intern at the Oakland Tribune, and that thing still isn't built, and that was more than 15 years ago. So I think the bottom line is there was a lot of money that was going to go to this project. It was going to be Star Wars plus. And the other thing is that the museum that this was going to be was a storytelling museum about the telling of stories and the narrative. Now, being a journalist and a storyteller and someone who has a program called Voices, where we train residents to be storytellers and then put their work, that is sort of how amazing that would have been for this community. And I think it's a real shame that we let it slip through our fingers.
Well, it's no sports basement.
Sorry?
It's no sports basement.
That's true. That was
their release extended. That's cool for Presidio. We're totally are cool with sports basement. Don Fisher, see ya. George Lucas,
right.
No way. A reasonably priced athletic wear, yes. We will have that.
Is this just a Presidio Trust thing, or is this that whole mix of San Francisco politics where everyone gets to vote on everything?
Well, it's not just that. I mean, there's sort of two factions, and I'm grossly generalizing here, but you have a number of people who don't want very wealthy people or even big corporations to build big projects. They're against them having any kind of assistance or tax breaks or anything that would actually make any project pencil out. And so they're sort of against the sort of intrusion of that. And then on the other side, you have people who don't want their view to change, who don't want their city to change. There's the NIMBYism part. But when these two groups get together, they're very dedicated, interested. They vote even on very low turnout elections, like the election that tanked 8 Washington, the election that just passed Proposition B. They're just a very motivated, dedicated group. And so we end up sort of institutionalizing their views in a city where, you know, polls show otherwise. Problem is we don't have as good turnout as we should because people assume that things are going to work out. And what we're seeing is over time, things don't work out. You know, eventually, we are not that great that George Lucas is going to say, oh, Chicago, I appreciate your $1 rent proposal, but I'm going to take over dilapidated piers for $30 million. Which, by the way, so the mayor comes out and says, well, I'm the mayor of San Francisco. I will promise you my full support. Well, that doesn't mean much in San Francisco when you have things like Proposition B and all the other institutional barriers. It's, you know, we appreciate that, but hey, Ed Lee, you know what? You were really on board with 8 Washington, too, and it didn't get built. So your assurances, and again, the incredibly, mathematically problematic, you know, negative $30 million that Lucas would have had to take on, right, didn't make any sense. And in a place like Chicago, where you have a mayor who can be more effective and can actually help you through a process, whose promise actually means something, you know, I think at some point people have to start realizing that we're driving away good projects, and that if we keep putting so many barriers in place, the only projects that will ever pencil out will be billion-dollar projects. And so we'll either have nothing, or we'll have megaplexes and sort of medium-sized, attempts at being aesthetically pleasing will never make any sense if we keep making it so difficult for people to build in the city. And I think people are learning that, but it's going to take some time after a number of these things keep happening, people, I think, will wise up, I hope, and be as motivated to come out and vote as the folks who were trying to prevent things from happening.
Well, wasn't there a big backlash? And this was actually before I came to the city. Willie Brown was seen by the progressive wing of the city as being too much in with the developers. There's too much going on. Too many of these decisions were being made in City Hall, and they wanted more city input. So do you think Mayor Lee is kind of trying to do whatever he's doing with an eye on, I don't want to lose the Board of Supervisors to a progressive takeover like Willie Brown had take happen?
Or lose re-election. I mean, he understands he's got to keep certain, again, very vocal minorities happy. And so, you know, he can try, and he has come out very strongly, like, in favor of the Washington Project. But, mm-hmm. I mean, at some point, when people keep putting things on the ballot, there's nothing you can do, even as mayor. You can make your promises, but...
Yeah, one of our audience members asked, do you hold Mayor Lee partly responsible for the Lucas debacle? It sounds like...
That's not the reaction that I was hearing from the people that were close
around
to it. No, he was very supportive and was clearly behind it. I think the real problem was with the forces that Alyssa is alluding to that were at play. And the trust itself, which according to this one source, I think there's a YMCA that's on... that's on the Presidio that's sort of outgrown itself and wants to expand. And it's having real difficult time dealing with the staff, according to this particular source. And I think that's a shame. I mean, what this particular person said is that we know what you don't stand for as a trust. What do you stand for? And what's the plan? Because obviously, presumably, the Presidio needs to have some projects that are going to help support it. And a project like that museum certainly would have been made it even more of a destination than it already is.
The members of the Presidio Trust are appointed by the president. And so Dianne Feinstein's letter right after we lost the Lucas Museum that actually said, you guys need to check yourselves. we may need to think about the composition of this trust. It is very important because if she nominates persons, obviously the president would take that very seriously. He doesn't care who's on the Presidio Trust. So, you know, it's going to be people like Dianne Feinstein and Nancy Pelosi who can lobby him to actually change the membership potentially at some point down the road based on their, if they can continue to be intractable. The Presidio is supposed to be self-supported, right? The reason why we got it back from the government was because we were supposed to be able to take it and make money off of it. And they keep poo-pooing every project, and we're never going to get there to that place that we're supposed to be by federal law, where it's supposed to be self-sustaining. So there may be some changes on the trust itself based on, you know, this string of problems.
Okay, let's go to the other side. Someone writes from the audience, I am against the George Lucas Museum, the Warrior Stadium. Obviously, there are a number of large projects that have met this opposition. This person says, I'm against these because San Francisco is a fabulous city with many tourists. We don't need to lure more people and visitors. The hotels are already filled. That's...
Get off my lawn.
Well...
I think that is a real tension here, though, because so much of what draws people to San Francisco is the aesthetics of the city, the Victorian homes, the views of the bay, you know, just that San Francisco feel when you walk down the streets, and that's important to preserve. But at the same time, San Francisco has always been a place where new people are welcome and new ideas are welcome, and I think that's important to preserve as well. So it seems like there must be some common ground, and, you know, Ed Lee has been able to get some things through. I mean, Twitter was able to come in. They made a lot of concessions for that to try to get mid-market built up. So I think that there, you know, there could be a way through to please both groups if they try.
Someone else asked, could the Lucas Project have gone somewhere else besides the Presidio? And I think that goes to, he did, after the Presidio Project effort fell through, they were talking about a place along the piers, which...
Piers 30 and 32, yeah. The dilapidated piers that the Warriors were initially looking at before they moved down to Mission Bay. So Mayor Lee offered to sell that land for the bargain price of $30 million to Lucas to build his museum there. But I have read, as somebody here who asked the question did, that he did it very late in the process, that Lucas was already so disgusted with his experience at the Presidio, and he was already being courted by Chicago, and kind of the effort by Mayor Lee to offer up this other real estate was just too little, too late.
Los Angeles also threw its hat in kind of late in the game, but still it was a sign of if San Francisco is not going to go after this aggressively, that other cities will realize, oh, and of course it would have been a good fit film-wise for that industry. Well, let's talk about something that has kind of happened over the past few days, and that has been the kind of the end-of-term decisions handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court. And just today we saw a big one, the so-called Hobby Lobby case that has been praised or condemned, depending on where you are on the issue. Molly, can I start with you? What about that case is significant? Why is that attracting so much attention?
So the Supreme Court ruled today that Hobby Lobby, which is a craft store sort of like Michael's, could exempt itself out of Obamacare's birth control mandate based on religious grounds. And so that ruling, when they handed it down, it was sort of touted as like a narrow ruling because it only applies to closely held companies. But it turns out that something like 90% of companies in the United States are closely held companies, which is only you have to have five owners or fewer. And this could impact up to 60 million people across the country. So it is a very important ruling and has a lot of implications. Something that's been raised as a concern is this a slippery slope? If a company can claim religious exemption to birth control, sort of what's next? What else? What other laws can they opt out of? So liberals are obviously very fired up about it, and I think as they should be.
Melissa, is this...
Okay, so to be clear, the decision only applied, obviously, to Hobby Lobby and this other cabinet-making company. There were two plaintiffs, basically, although theirs isn't as easy to say or even remember. But anyway, so that's why it's the Hobby Lobby case. So the court said that, basically, Obamacare's contraception mandate applies to for-profit companies, but it doesn't apply to a nonprofit can get an exemption. Right? It's an easy thing for a nonprofit to do. And they did that because we have a tradition of letting religious organizations more closely hew to their conscience. They're able to opt out of a number of federal laws, and choose their employees more carefully in accordance with their religious beliefs, et cetera. So they said, what the court said was, the distinction between for-profit and profit doesn't make any sense. They said, we're going to strike down this distinction. So while Hobby Lobby is itself, and the other, the carpentry company, are closely held family-run corporations, there's nothing in the decision that says this only applies to closely held corporations, which, as one legal professor has claimed, are 90% of companies. So if, for example, we were stockholders of Apple, and we got together and we could all decide, based on our company's bylaws, we could all come up with a decision about what our religion is and declare one religion. Under this decision, there's nothing limiting it. All it did was strike down that wall between nonprofit and profit. We could, arguably, come together, declare ourselves of one religion, and then try to opt out of the contraception mandate or perhaps another kind of mandate. So people say it's narrowly drawn, but understand they were only considering these very closely held corporations. There's nothing in the decision that says this only applies to closely held corporations.
And I'm sorry, you just touched on something. You said the contraceptive mandate or another mandate. Is that also part of the fear that this then could be applied to other parts of either Obamacare or to other?
Because the decision says we are only applying this to contraception.
Okay.
Having said that, I mean, it's technically it's not the holding because it wasn't at issue. So it's what we call dicta, and it means that it's just sort of them opining and saying, well, we're not going to think this way about something else, but that wasn't before them. So something else could certainly come before them. And Justice Ginsburg's dissent very clearly says, I'm concerned. So Scientologists who believe that psychiatric care shouldn't be covered, or certain people of Muslim belief, for example, who don't want to have vaccines or antibiotics that derive from pork products, that's a problem. I mean, there's an additional religion, I forget which one, that doesn't allow blood transfusions. So she said, it's not.
Christian Science.
There you go. Thank you. So she said, just because you say, oh, we won't apply to this, doesn't mean that this won't come before us, and that if you use the same standard you used here, that wouldn't actually be upheld. So she was very, very concerned about this and recognized that it actually is a very broad ruling potentially based on later decisions. But for today, the court said you can opt out of the contraception mandate. They also said that what you should do is use that mechanism that you give nonprofits. So if a nonprofit says, I don't want to cover contraception, the way it works is you file a piece of paper, and your insurance company has to provide it. You don't have to pay for it, but your insurance company has to provide it. That's how nonprofits get. That's how we get coverage of women for nonprofits. So the proposal is to do that. Again, what the judges said was the justices said is that you should do that in for-profit companies and opt out. So to be clear, they weren't saying that women wouldn't have contraceptive coverage. They weren't saying that you'd be left out in the cold. You have to come out of pocket for it. They were just saying you would use that same mechanism for having the insurance company swoop in and provide it without your consent. Hopefully, that will do it for us. So. Hopefully that clarifies a little bit.
It's always commented sometimes when there's like a really controversial decision that's expected to be delivered, you know, the last day before they head off to vacation or whatever they do between terms. Do you think there's any truth to that, that they kind of hold certain things to, okay, Hobby Lobby, let's get out of town?
Well, it may be that. Yeah, the last one, they were like, no, my bye-bye. It may be that, but it's also a really long decision. The decision itself is 40 pages, and then there's like a 4-page concurrence, and then there's a 25-page dissent. I think it actually took their staff a really long time to write it and put it together. It seems like from a physical, logistical standpoint, it took a really long time to write. A lot longer than some of the other decisions. You know, we've seen so many unanimous decisions this term. I think people, have been misled into thinking there's some kumbaya going on in the Supreme Court. No. But this one was very, very divisive. So I think it just literally took a little longer. But, I'm not saying it didn't help. But there's no indication that they do that for political reasons.
Martin, there have been, like I said, a number of these big decisions or decisions that have gotten a lot of attention over the past few days. Which one stands out for you?
Well, I just think this decision today just stands out the most to me, where you're sort of enabling a corporation to act as though it's an individual, essentially, and say, well, these are my collective beliefs. And I just don't think I think it sets a dangerous precedent. And I think if that were the case, then you could apply that to, say, GM, for instance, which is culpable for the deaths of 13 people in recalled vehicles. Shouldn't therefore the corporation go to jail? You could say that also in terms of the bailout, right? These corporations were bailed out, so technically you're bailing out individuals. So where does this stop? I think it sets a bad precedent. I also don't like the message what it says to women, that somehow, sure, you can file this additional paper, you can go around this way, and you will get covered, but they can do this. Because whenever we're talking about men or contraception or some sort of thing to deal with our dysfunction, if you will, all of those options are covered, no problem. But where is the equity for women as it relates to reproductive rights and the needs that they have? So I think it's egregious.
Another big case, and I honestly don't know how big of a case this was. I'm still kind of trying to determine that from what I've read, is the one about public unions. It had to do with partial employees, meaning part-time employees or contractors. Does anyone have a...
I understand it had to do with home health care workers not having to pay into union dues. There was a woman who was taking care of, I think, of her son, and she was being paid by the state to take care of her son, and this enables her to not have to pay the union dues to do that, which I guess actually makes some sense.
Melissa?
So in this case, the issue was, traditionally speaking, in Illinois, it varies from state to state, and we can talk about California in a little bit, but in Illinois, the person who's being taken care of is the customer, right? So it's the caretaker, and then your boss, right? That's your employer, is the person who you're caring for. That's been the traditional relationship. The caretaker, who can and often is a member of the person's family, still has an employer-employee relationship, and they have the system of care has to be approved by a doctor, and that's kind of the universe of it. And then Medicare pays the state gives me my money. That has traditionally been like the setup. What Illinois did is, in 2003, Governor Blagojevich gets into office after receiving lots of money from unions.
Blagojevich,
we're bringing it back. We're going back to 2003. Governor Blagojevich gets into office, and he sends an executive order, and he says, okay, all of you are now employees of the state. You are no longer just employees of the person who you're taking care of. You're employees of the state, and as such, we're going to unionize you under the SEIU, and we're going to negotiate with the SEIU about your employment, And you now have to pay the SEIU union dues. Right, I know, right? That's what the judges said, too. And so in this case, when we talk about a partial employer, the argument was, hey, my client is my employer. The state is not my employer. The state just cuts me the check from Medicaid that I'm getting from the federal government anyway. So the court in this case said, you cannot compel somebody who is partially employed, who became partially employed by fiat, and who became unionized by fiat to pay union dues. They said, no, that's too much. Now, there was a danger here that the court could have said, we hate all public employee unions, and we don't think anybody should be compelled to pay union dues by virtue of being employed by the state. But they didn't do that. They beat up some legal precedent pretty good with it, but they didn't go that far. They just said, in this case where you have this kind of workers and this set of circumstances, this is unconstitutional abridgment of freedom of speech. So it just applies to the part, what they called the sort of traditional full-time public employees are not affected in the case. But in doing that, in ruling that, there's some legal precedent about public employee unions and their ability to extract union dues from all employees of a certain kind that they did a number on. And it seems like for a lot of liberal commentators that they're sort of laying the groundwork and extending really a bigger invitation for your traditional public employee unions to come forward and challenge their union due checkoff in the Supreme Court.
I'm glad you went back to 2003, because anyone who thinks we maybe pick on Rick Perry and Chris Christie and other Republican governors too much, just remember Rod Blagojevich. Molly, do you think this, should people, are labor folks worried about this, or are they seeing it as fairly narrow?
Well, I think what Melissa said is very true, that this ruling, it was considered a blow by the labor unions, but it's more a precursor of what's to come, and especially with this court and the makeup on the court, I think labor unions are very worried right now.
I saw something today that Democrats are actually using some of these decisions and trying to spin it into an election year help to them. Hey, look, this is why we need to keep the Senate. I'm sure the other side will be rallying on the other side, too. This is why we need to change the Senate, because the Senate, of course, approves Supreme Court nominations. But, well, let us move on to our next topic, then. And that is, I have to find it, we have so many topics today. California has a new person in the leadership of the U.S. House of Representatives in Washington. For those of you who did not hear, you should pay your Comcast bill, because it would be really hard to have not heard this. Eric Cantor was the House Majority Leader, the leader of the Republicans in the U.S. House, and he lost his primary. He was the first House Majority Leader to lose a primary since the position was created in 1899, I believe it was. Well, so there were a lot of jockeying after that to try to replace him, and Kevin McCarthy of California won. And I just wanted to talk about, what do we know about Kevin McCarthy? Do we know of any impact you think this might have, either on Republican policies or on the way the House is run? Molly, what are you hearing?
Well, Kevin McCarthy, I think, isn't a huge national figure, but in Washington, he's definitely considered a power player. He came up through the assembly here in California, and he's actually the least tenured, or will be the least tenured, majority leader ever. Right. And he also has a pretty thin legislative record. He's only sponsored himself introduced three bills, and only two of those got passed. And one, I think, was a post office renaming, and the other was a space center renaming. So he hasn't done a whole lot. He didn't spend a whole.
He didn't spend a whole lot of time. Someone's got
to name them. So. Yeah, I mean, that's what they do most of the time. but yeah, he doesn't have the same legislative chops that Eric Cantor had. But really, what he's known for is being a deal maker, and he was known for that in the assembly here, and that's what he has kind of made a name for himself with in D.C. He was the whip, which their responsibility is to get all the votes together in the caucus. And, he's just kind of a collegial guy. He had Kevin Spacey shadow him when he was studying for his role in House of Cards as Frank Underwood. Mm-hmm. He was the guy in 2011 before the Republicans tried to shut down the government the first time, he put on the Ben Affleck movie, The Town, to get the Republicans riled up. So he's kind of, you know, a character in the House. So he has that going for him. But I think, you know, legislatively, he's not the biggest power player. But he has said that he's going to give a lot of power to the party chairman, which really could change legislation a lot. There's a lot of conservatives that are in really high-powered spots on the committees. And I think that's going to be something important to watch there.
Martin, he represents a very farming-heavy agricultural area, but also a large Latino population.
Yeah, 35% of his constituents are Latino, and of course represents that farming area, which has obviously business interests there. And his, and you know, the word is that he's going to have to sort of walk a fine line, because he's a Republican who does support immigration reform, not for citizenship, but for legalization, and which obviously will help the constituents in that farming community. And so he'll have to sort of walk that fine line. And the other line he'll have to walk is that, for the most part, GOP leadership that ascends to that level comes from states that are not Democratic. They come from much more conservative states. So how are his colleagues going to line up behind him when he's like, well, you can't even get your own house in order? So so I think it'll be interesting to see how that line and how he walks it. But as Melissa points out, in his other voting, he's definitely along the GOP line.
Tell us about that.
He's
Melissa.
Far from moderate. Yeah, we were chatting about this in the green room. He's far from moderate. Like he's not a Tea Partier in the sense he doesn't want to kill the government and you know, what, shrink it and send it down the drain. But he votes. He's very, very pro life. He's very pro gun. It's very hard to find a lot of sunlight between him and even more extreme members of the party. So his voting record is not, even though he's not a Tea Partier necessarily, he votes one particular way, even though Democrats like him, because he's affable. I was reading this book called Ask Not What Good We Do. It's clunkily worded title, but it's a good book about the Tea Party ascension in Congress. And they describe Kevin McCarthy as this guy who knows when your anniversary is. He knows your kids' names, he knows your dog's name, he knows your favorite food. And he's very good at remembering all of this and bringing people together on a regular basis, very affable, very well-liked. And I know majority leader is not like prom queen, but it does apparently go a long way to getting the votes that he needed when he needed them after Cantor's loss. And it's why even Democrats aren't totally, you know, dismissive of him. But the other thing I'll say that we were talking about is that he's in Silicon Valley all the time. He does not represent Silicon Valley, but at least once a month he's there. The tech people know him. If you talk to Silicon Valley folks about the Republican Party, they will tell you that he is the guy who really gets it, who shows up, who talks to them about what their needs are. And so if we're thinking of, like, what is California going to do? What can we see? What can we maybe expect? Is maybe some additional technology-related legislation or some assistance on getting some votes for maybe that part of the immigration reform that allows more H-1B visas, for example. So his technology expertise and, again, the respect that he has in the community in Silicon Valley, I think, you know, is the one thing we can maybe point to as going a long way in addition to, you know, lovely Christmas gifts.
Okay, well, let's move on then to some other election news, and let's do local, national, state. I mean, you mentioned Hillary Clinton before. She's had an interesting week or so with
bless her heart.
Yeah, she was before. she of course got quite a bit of criticism for mentioning that when she and Bill Clinton left the White House, they were broke. I think my favorite.
And this after Chelsea Clinton's getting paid $600,000 a year from, what is it, NBC?
NBC. Yeah.
To do segments like Happy Birthday, Statue of Liberty. You know, like, everyone in the media was like, what? Yeah. So, you know, they have a different idea.
My favorite line, I'm just going to steal from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, which is one of the panelists there said, yes, it was so terrible they had almost considered having to sell some of their art.
Yeah.
But This far in advance, I mean, except for political roundtables, do people care about kind of the misstatements? Unless, like we were talking before with a Rick Perry, where it becomes, you consider the person a walking, you know, repeat offender, that kind of thing.
It's, you know, if someone followed me around all day with a tape recorder, I think I'd be in a lot of trouble. I mean, I feel bad for these candidates. Yeah. They can't have a moment of a mess up. Having said that, this whole income inequality thing, I think, is sort of a new subject for her to deal with. Remember 2008 when she was running, that was not necessarily the main subject that you had to be conversant upon. She hangs out with super wealthy, amazing people. Like, she's at Davos, for goodness sake. I mean, she considered, you know, it's when you're spending your time with people like that, then you can lose perspective, I think. And she hasn't really developed a vocabulary for how to deal with this. Having said that, you know, her thing is not a bootstrap story, right? You don't vote for her because you go, well, there's a lady who made something out and just being the wife of the president. You know, like, you don't, you know, she's not, we don't look for her, we don't look to her for that. So she doesn't have to try as hard, maybe, you know, as some other candidates, because it's not why you like her. And she's a better known candidate for other things. And so, you know, mm-hmm. she needs to find a way to connect with people and warm up to people. There's no question about that. But it's going to be a little clunky to wade into the income inequality waters for her. And, you know, frankly, to your point, I think getting it out of the way early is the better bet. So by the time the election comes, if she runs, then she'll sort of have it down. But I think this is new territory for her.
Yeah. Scott Walker, again, from Wisconsin, the governor there, he had a bad couple days a while ago when it was reported that Wisconsin has a system called John Doe investigations, which are kind of like grand juries, where they do, in secret, or in private at least, these investigations of potential corruption, and then if they come to fruition, they make it public. Well, through some interesting court maneuvering, the John Doe investigation in question was shut down by a judge. However, the judge then allowed the prosecutors to release their documents. These documents, among other things, accused Governor Walker of being at the center of a criminal scheme and this involved coordinating financing during the recall elections that you've all heard about back, that made Wisconsin briefly interesting nationally. Molly, has that been his Chris Christie Bridgegate moment where it took some of the wind out of his sails among his potential presidential supporters?
You know, I think to some extent, yes. You know, you never want to have criminal investigation in the headline when you're
bad bumper
trying
sticker.
To be president. But I think it is such a complex case that confuses voters so much. It confused a lot of people. It confused me. It confused a lot of people in my office of what was actually going on there. That I don't know if it's the same sort of devastating hit that Bridgegate is for Christie. I think my mic went out, but let me just speak loudly.
Here, why don't we try that?
Sure. Does that work?
Try it.
Hello?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
But I do think it's important to remember it is only 2014. At this point in the cycle, in the 2008 campaign, it would have been 2006, and people weren't really sure Obama was even going to run at that point. So it's a lot of time, and I think anything that happens now, obviously, if it's negative, it's not great, but I don't think it's devastating.
Okay. Martin, we were talking before about the Oakland race, and which was the candidate you were talking about?
Oh, Rebecca Kaplan jumped into the race.
Now, for those of us who are not from Oakland,
I'll tell you a little bit about her. Yeah, she's a at-large council member who's on her second term. Before that, she was on the AC Transit Board, I believe, and so she represents all of Oakland. There's specific districts, and then Kaplan is the only at-large council member, and she's run for mayor before. And it was the year that Kwan won, so now she sort of waited around. There's only 17 candidates running for mayor. So she tried to wait a little bit longer and then jump in with a little bit of bling and splash. But the problem is, you know, a lot of people, the critics of Kaplan are that she's sort of a mile wide but only an inch deep. And that's not my words, but those are the words of some critics, that she doesn't tend to take a stand, this is what folks allege, and therefore she's very popular. She's by far the most popular and has a real shot to win, certainly with ranked choice voting, where the tallies keep going on until, you know, somebody's second and third choice, until a candidate gets 50% of the vote plus one.
And because she's an at-large, she has a wider name recognition than
that's right.
District folks.
Yeah, but I still think it's a toss-up, and I think ranked choice voting is real unfortunate for a city like Oakland that has a lot of complex issues because you don't get a chance to vet sort of the final two candidates and really rake them over the coals like you want to do and kick the tires. And so I think it's unfortunate and that the whole system is set up to where somebody who maybe not even be the candidate people really wanted because of ranked choice and perhaps because they align themselves with another candidate was able to rise to the top and get the votes they need to be the next mayor.
Okay. Well, before we do our news quiz, let's run through some questions from the audience here. And there are several on our favorite topic tonight of George Lucas. And one person wanted to write on both sides, so felt very strong. This is, George Lucas was unwilling to work with the Presidio Trust to find a more suitable site in the Presidio, and it was he who basically walked away from the table rather than San Francisco, who walked away from the table. And someone else writes, Donald Fisher was denied a space in the Presidio, but he persisted, and he found a different location. Why couldn't Lucas do that? A billionaire. And are there any good arguments for rejection of the Lucas project? So, anyone want to jump on a grenade?
Well, look, I think the issue isn't necessarily, you know, what are the merits of the project, but it was that the Presidio Trust put out a series of they asked for RFIs, right? So they said, people, give us your proposals, and then a group did, and they narrowed it down to three, and then they said, okay, three, come back and make your proposals consistent with this group of requirements. Okay, so we have a whole new, now you three people have already gone through this, we're going to make you go through it again, and we have a whole new set of requirements. So they did. They spent millions of dollars, and all three groups came back and gave proposals that were consistent with those requirements, and then they still all got dinged. So it was, I think the issue isn't necessarily like what's the upside versus the downside. It's that the process really would have turned anyone off of, you know, you keep moving the goalposts, I think is what he has said publicly. And his representatives have said publicly, I'm not talking out of school here, that they felt like that the goalposts kept getting moved. So I think that was the bigger issue, not really, you know,
yeah, I don't think
what color the Presidio was going to be painted.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's arguing with checks and balances, but when the checks and balances keep moving, that's a problem.
Okay. On our other topic of Rick Perry and gay marriage and gay rights, someone asks, does anyone on the panel think that the radical homosexual movement is taking away our freedom of speech? Is this the new fight that we have? Does anyone think that?
No.
Didn't think so. And then, can the Republican Party, this goes, I guess, to our first topic, can the Republican Party really reinvent itself by moving to the center socially when Democrats, like Governor Brown, have so adroitly become fiscal conservatives? Too little, too late. Is there room there for them to grab much?
I mean, being a person of color, I would never, and the people that I talk to of my hue and background, I think that there's the perception that we wouldn't be welcome in the Republican Party, and for a lot of reasons. And being the way that the rhetoric is, that it seems to be a very, not a very inclusive group of people, let's just put it that way, I would be surprised, and at a time when the country is becoming more diverse, I think it's a real problem for the Republican Party. How are you truly going to make folks feel as though they are actually welcome? Not that you're sort of pandering and sort of trying to move yourself to their direction so you can get their votes, but that your values actually align with their concerns. And I don't see how, for many people, that they're going to buy that.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
I'll point out, too, that Jerry Brown is an anomaly. I mean, he is not necessarily representative of all Democratic politicians. There are lots of Democrats in Sacramento who hate him, who see a huge surplus and want to spend it, and are mad that he stands in their way repeatedly. So Jerry Brown may have done a decent job triangulating and preventing Neil Kashkari from getting much traction, but it remains to be seen if the next Democratic nominee is able to do the same thing. Would Kamala Harris be able to do that? It's not clear. So, I mean, it still doesn't mean that there's no room sort of in the middle for a socially liberal, more fiscally conservative. And by the way, Jerry Brown is not the most fiscally conservative person that one could be. Like, I think people think there are lots of people who still wish he were more so. So I think there's ground there as well.
Any addition?
And I think with young voters, I've met a lot of people who say they would consider voting Republican if the social issues weren't a part of it. You know, if it wasn't so vehemently opposed to abortion rights and to gay marriage. So I think that's, you know, an important thing for the Republican Party to look at. But going back to Martin's point, you know, for every step forward that's taken, you know, in states like California where Republicans are moving to the left on social issues, you have situations like in the Mississippi Senate primary last week where Thad Cochran went out into the Mississippi Delta and had his campaign workers recruit black voters to come to the polls and say, hey, this is going to be a little bit better for you if Chris McDaniel, than Chris McDaniel would be, who was the Tea Party challenger. And Chris McDaniel just went out there and completely tore apart Thad Cochran, accused him of using liberal Democrats and black voters to get in office. And, you know, that's something that's setting back the Republican Party again. So I think they really do have huge issues to deal with at the national level before things can really change, even at the state level.
Okay, well, on that note, let's do our news quiz before we head out into the dark night. If Fran, my prize deliverer, could come up. I'm going to ask a question. If you think you know the answer, raise your hand. I'll select you and shout out your answer, or at least say it loudly. And if you win, you'll get a little bag of Ghirardelli chocolates. So it's worth fighting over. Okay. So the first question is, what did the group called ISIS declare over the weekend? I saw your hand first, sir. You, right, yeah.
Islamic State in Iraq.
And part of Syria, yeah, that's right. That's right, he got it. They declared a caliphate, an Islamic State, in the parts of Iraq and Syria that they control. Our next question, President Obama is seeking to address what immigration issue with $2 billion? Did anyone, way in the back, your hand up? That's right, the unaccompanied minors, the children who are being crossing the border into the United States. Next question, President Obama is nominating a former Procter & Gamble CEO to be head of what? And sir, I saw your hand. That's right, the Department of Veterans Affairs. Fran, did you see who it was? Okay. The next question, a power failure stranded dozens of people 200 feet in the air at, where did this happen? Did you see this story?
Yeah.
Anybody? Sorry? SeaWorld, that's right. Very good. And I had a Hobby Lobby question that you would all get, so we'll just go over that one. How did ISIS, the group that declared this Islamic State, how did ISIS deal with 8 Muslims it deemed to be too moderate? Specifically, what was their punishment?
Death.
How did they kill them is really what
be
I'm getting.
Be more graphic.
Yes. No, do you want to? No? I'm sure they'll get around to those too, but sir, that's right, they crucified them. Then they beheaded and then they shot them, perhaps.
Then they shot them.
Okay. Former U.S. Senator Nancy Kassebaum of Kansas lost her husband this week. Who passed away at the age of 88, sir?
Howard Baker.
Howard Baker, that's right. He was the former Senate Majority Leader, and he was also Chief of Staff to President Reagan during his final couple of years. And let's see. Fran, how many do we have left? Israeli security officials said they found the bodies of whom? Ma'am in the white. Oh, I pointed at 2 people in white, but that's right. There are 3 teenagers who had been believed to be kidnapped in the West.
They found
their bodies, so they were dead. I do not have happy questions this week, do I?
Yeah,
you got some depressing questions.
Okay.
Why don't you say who won the best album in the BET Awards?
Because I don't know the answer.
Bet you none of you get that.
He just wants chocolate, because he would know the answer.
Pharrell.
He won the BET Awards. Okay, let's try. Former San Francisco Mayor Willie Brown mediated a contract between San Francisco and whom? What organization? Sir?
The
FDIU? No. Was there another hand?
Union.
Specific. Not the Longshoremen, no. I think there's state workers in Illinois, but actually, you are correct. It was the Muni operators, if you remember the sick out that we recently endured. And
the handsome man in the purple.
Yes.
My husband.
The ringer in the audience there. Okay, one last question then. What did President Obama call a stunt? Standing in the back. John Boehner suing President Obama over the use of executive power. That is correct. Well, thank you, everybody, very much for coming. We will have more news quiz questions and, of course, much more to discuss on the Monday, July 14th, and when we return for our next week-to-week political roundtable. Thanks to our panel, Molly Riley, Martin G. Reynolds, Melissa Griffin-Kane. Thanks to all of you and everyone listening and watching. Have a great week.